From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Back in the 1970s, a book called The Secret Life of Plants made the case that trees and flowers and vegetables were sort of just like us, our green brothers and sisters grooving and gabbing. Well, no, it turns out. But if you think there's nothing going on in the greenhouse, the backyard, the woods, well, wrong again. It turns out plants are seeing, smelling, feeling, remembering. This hour on Point, what plants know. You can join the conversation. Are you tuned in to your plants' senses? Do you think of them watching you? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now in the studio is Daniel Shamovitz. He's director of the Mana Center for Plant Biosciences at Tel Aviv University and author of the new book, What a Plant Knows, a Field Guide to the Senses. Daniel Shamovitz, welcome. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So here we go again. Plants all around, sort of just talking and watching and looking and feeling and seeing and knowing. What do you mean when you say what a plant knows? Is that like you and I knowing something?
Well, yeah, it's a pretty unorthodox use of the word know. But if you think about knowing as being aware, like, you know, if you're in the middle of the night and you see some light coming at you and you see a car and you run out of the way, you're aware of that light and you know it and you respond. So plants are aware of quite a bit that's going on. So they know things. They don't know how to do linear algebra, of course, but they know quite a bit.
Not yet. Maybe they'll study up. I mean, this is quite a table of contents here. What a plant sees, what a plant smells, what a plant feels, hears. Not much. We'll look at that. What a plant, how a plant knows where it is, what a plant remembers. And you take it all the way back. You say if you go deep enough, I mean, never mind the secret life of plants, but if you go deep enough in the genomics, we have got some roots in common.
We definitely have some roots in common. You have to remember that, you know, 2 billion years ago, we and oaks have the same ancestor. The same single cell that led to all eukaryotes was common to all animals and all plants. And so any genes that were necessary for a cell to function are found in all of life.
Including sensory genes? Can you find sensory genes in humans and plants today that are related?
Including sensory genes. For example, you know, I just came from abroad and I'm under some pretty bad jet lag. Even back 2 billion years ago, cells had to respond to changing light conditions, to know when it was morning, know when it was evening. And so they did this according to the light environment. So the same genes that regulate our internal clocks, some of them are conserved between plants and animals.
I wonder if you'd read a little bit from the book. I've got a piece from early on here.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Just to give us a sense. It's such a wonderful, nuanced sense of plants' sense that you describe. Yes, please.
Sure. So, indeed, we tend not to pay much attention to the immensely sophisticated sensory machinery in the flowers and trees that can be found right in our own backyards. While most animals can choose their environments, seek shelter in a storm, search for food and a mate, or migrate with the changing seasons, plants must be able to withstand and adapt to constantly changing weather, encroaching neighbors, and invading pests without being able to move to a better environment. Because of this, plants have evolved complex sensory and regulatory mechanisms that allow them to modulate their growth in response to this ever-changing conditions. An elm tree has to know if its neighbor is shading it from the sun so that it can find its own way to grow toward the light that's available. A head of lettuce has to know if there are ravenous aphids about to eat it so that it can protect itself by making poisonous chemicals to kill the pests. A Douglas fir tree has to know if whipping winds are shaking its branches so that it can grow a stronger trunk. Cherry trees have to know when to flower.
That's a lot of knowing to be done. Daniel Shamovitz reading there from his new book, What a Plant Knows, a Field Guide to the Senses. Take us in. Seeing. You say plants can see. Now, what do you mean by that? They don't have eyeballs, exactly.
They don't have eyeballs, and they don't see in pictures. But if seeing is getting light signal and, again, responding to it, plants see quite a bit. Actually, they see more than we do. You know, we see red light, green light, blue light. Plants also see UV light, far red light, things that are outside of our spectrum. I think it's pretty surprising to know that plants differentiate colors. Now, is this seeing? Let's do a little thought experiment, can we, for a second?
Okay, yes.
So if you were completely blind, or if you know someone who's completely blind, and you would, through surgery, allow them now to be able to differentiate between light and dark, or maybe even add some color to it without pictures.
Be a big deal.
For that person, that would be a remediator, remediary vision. So plants definitely see that. They don't need to see pictures because their evolutionary trajectory didn't need pictures. But they need to see light because it's their food. They need to find their food.
Why do they see different colors of light? What's the purpose of that? Presumably there is a purpose.
Oh, there's definitely a purpose. Again, we have to figure out which color. So if we go back to the idea of plants need to see their food, they need to find their food so that they can do photosynthesis. So, for example, many of you may have seen that your plants in your windowsills bend towards the window. They bend towards the light.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the photosynthesis that's doing that. It's a different part of the spectrum that they're seeing so that they can find the light. Actually, it's only blue light. It's an experiment that Darwin did 130 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a seedling and put it in a dark room with a red light on one side and a blue light on the other,
mm-hmm.
it'll bend to the blue one.
Because the blue light is going to give it what?
Because it has a blue light receptor that lets it know that here is the light, and blue is part of the spectrum for photosynthesis.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it knows if I grow in that direction, I can now do photosynthesis.
Mm-hmm.
It's not chlorophyll that's doing it. It's a completely different photoreceptor.
You would think it would be the chlorophyll's involved in photosynthesis, so you'd think that would drive the process.
But that's not what's driving the process.
Mm-hmm.
The chlorophyll is only doing the photosynthesis. It's this other photoreceptor, just like the proteins we have in our retinas that allow us to see blue light. Plants have a photoreceptor that is specific for blue light and makes the plant bend to it.
You say plants monitor their visible environment all the time. Plants see if you come near them. They know when you stand over them. They even know if you're wearing a blue or red shirt.
Sure, because again, one of the ways plants know their environment is by the spectral qualities, which colors are available. If plants are too close to each other, or if you're shading them, then they're not getting enough red light. Red light is what they need for photosynthesis. So we're getting into a completely...
Wait, I thought it was blue.
For real photosynthesis, they need red. Blue helps part of the photosynthesis.
Okay.
It gets really complex.
Okay.
Here. I'm going to try to take
right.
this slowly.
Okay.
So one of the way a plant knows if it's in the shade or not,
mm-hmm.
not from the direction, but if it's in the shade, is the ratio between the amount of red light and the amount of far red light.
Okay.
Far red light is what you see at the end of the day as the sun's just going down.
And that's important, too, for the sort of daily cycle
exactly.
of the plant. You say when it sees that kind of far red light, it's time for it to turn off. Go to bed.
Right. But also when it sees this far red light, it thinks it's in the shade. And the reason it is because through photosynthesis, a leaf will absorb all the red light and do photosynthesis,
mm-hmm.
but the far red light will go through the leaf.
Mm-hmm.
So if a plant is seeing a lot of far red light, it thinks it's in the shade, so it's not getting any food. So that's when it'll try to grow really tall and spindly to get out of the shade.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to know all the time, am I getting enough red light? Am I shaded by my neighbors? If you're standing next to it, you're shading it, so it's going to grow longer to get out of the shade. It doesn't know that you're Tom shading it.
Mm-hmm,
it thinks someone else is.
Yeah, but when you say plants see if you come near them, is that just if I shade the plant? That's the only way it knows?
Well, shade, shadow, but also, again, if you're wearing a colored shirt that would be absorbing
mm-hmm.
the red light,
or mm-hmm.
that's sort of similar to being a leaf next to it that's absorbing out the red light.
That's amazing. So there is a kind of vision, not eyeball vision. We have to sort of lift the concepts here
exactly.
a little bit, not to be anthropocentric.
You know, we really always, and it's normal, to see mm-hmm. biology through our own, literally through our own
They're
eyes.
They're not seeing unless they see the way we see.
Exactly.
That would be the narrow vision.
Yeah, you know, we're trapped. Egocentric because we're comparing mm-hmm. ourselves to other people. Mm-hmm. We could be ethnocentric, you
mm-hmm.
know, unfortunately, comparing
mm-hmm.
ourselves
sure.
to other peoples. We are species-centric, definitely, but mm-hmm. we can understand, like, dogs because we can identify with them.
Mm-hmm.
Chimpanzees, maybe the dolphins.
Once they come to us, they want to be fed.
But we don't really identify with plants because there's nothing that we see that is similar. But deep down in, there's a lot of similarity. Deep in the plant, there's a huge amount of similarity. So this is definitely vision. And the interesting thing is scientists, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. my colleagues,
mm-hmm.
we can make plants that are colorblind. Just like there are people...
Why would you do that?
In order to study the processes,
okay.
we use genetics.
Mm-hmm,
and so
sure.
we make mutants.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are plants that are colorblind to blue light. Just like there are people...
They must be in trouble.
They don't know
which way to turn.
They don't turn at all. They just keep going straight. They don't bend to the blue light.
Uh-huh.
And we use... So these would never survive in nature. They only
mm-hmm.
grow in our greenhouses
mm-hmm.
and growth chambers. But so we use these type of mutants in order to study the processes and really understand the molecular basis of how plants sense light.
It's funny, you're telling us don't be species-centric when it comes to understanding vision. On the other hand, you're using all these words, see, smell, feel, know, in part to make us see our commonality with plants, open our minds to the fact that they are engaged in processes which are not...
I realize the words are so controversial. Mm-hmm. And whether you agree, whether we can call it sight or just responding to the electromagnetic spectrum that we see.
It sounds like a kind of sight to me.
Exactly. You know, actually, the people who have the biggest problems with it are neurobiologists. Because I'm going to insult some of my closest colleagues.
Okay.
But, you know, if we're talking about being species-centric, you know, they really want to think that, you know, if you have to have a brain to have senses. And you don't. I don't want to sit on a lemon tree. I'm stepping around in the desert of joy. Maybe anyhow I'll get another toy and everything will happen. And you wonder. I wonder how, I wonder why. Yesterday you told me about the blue, blue sky. And all that I can see is just another lemon tree. I'm turning my head up and down. I'm turning, 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 turning around. And all that I can see is just a yellow lemon tree. And I wonder, wonder, wonder.
Feed me!
Does it have to be human?
Feed me!
Does it have to be mine?
Feed me!
Where am I supposed to get it?
Feed me, Seymour. Feed me all night long. That's right, boy!
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Okay, Little Shop of Horrors, it is not. The music there from the Broadway show where the Venus flytrap is saying, feed me. And it's just not going to happen exactly that way, but... my guest today says plants can see and feel and sense your touch and remember. Daniel Samovitz is with us. He's a biologist from Tel Aviv University with a new book, What a Plant Knows, and it is a lot, as he describes it. You can read an excerpt from the book at our website. You're laughing as we hear Little Shop of Horrors saying, okay, it's not Seymour and Audrey here.
Yeah, but everyone thinks of that immediately when I tell them about the book and get really scared.
Yeah. The Venus flytrap is a plant you point to and say, look, just look what goes on here. Remind us.
Well, that's the plant, one plant that we can actually identify with because we see its movements. You know, plants, most plants live on a time scale that we don't understand.
And
we
move
don't
on
see.
That kind of time scale generally.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, some are pretty quick.
But yeah, well, the Venus flytrap is one of them. We can actually see, you know, like a little fly going in and then it closes. And we actually think that it's really eating like we eat because, you know, it has these little...
So like jaws.
So
like
jaws closing and, you know, so we can identify with that. But so the question, though, is, you know, how does the flytrap know, and I'll use the word know, that the fly is ready there to be eaten?
And Darwin, I think it was, pointed out that it knows the difference between a drop of rain and a fly settling on its surface.
Exactly.
That's pretty sensitive.
So there's information processing. You know, what is knowing? It's information processing. And so there's information processing going on in the Venus flytrap. And what's happening is that if you look closely, there's like these big black hairs, not hairs like ours, but we'll call them hairs. They look like it. Filaments on the surface of the flytrap. And as a fly goes around, it touches one, then it doesn't close yet. If it touches a second one, but rather quickly, like within 20 seconds, then it'll close. If you wait more than 20 seconds, it doesn't. So why the 20 seconds? Because the trap only wants to close if what's inside is big enough to eat. You know, it takes a lot of energy.
Snap on a gnat or
exactly,
a raindrop.
Are you going to want to eat one? Exactly. You want a nut
want
or
a real meal?
You want a real meal.
I don't want tapas.
Exactly. And actually, it takes a lot of energy for it to reopen after it's closed. You know, if it's closing on just like a, you know, something, just a snack, it's not worth it. So if you have a fly trap at home, don't be closing it all the time just to show your kids because you'll kill it. Anyway, it'll die of malnutrition. But going back to it, so how does it know? You know, so it touches one hair. It remembers that one hair has been touched. Then it touches the other one, and then that, if it's quick enough, it recalls the first information that it was touched, and then it snaps shut. And how does it snap shut? It generates an electric signal. Now think about this. When a fly or a mosquito lands on your arm, on your hairs, you know, you feel it because your nerves have an electric signal going through them to the brain. Here, you're touching these hairs, and you're getting an electric signal going through the leaves of the Venus flytrap without nerves. and that's leading to it to close.
But there's an important word that's not in that sentence, and that is brain. I mean, we have a brain to process all this. When you say information processing, what does that mean if you don't have a central nervous system and you don't have a brain?
Again, we're being species-specific.
Oh, geez.
Species-centric. Okay. Sorry.
Chauvinistic,
you know,
human.
There are very, I'll use the word, lower animals, mm-hmm. you know, certain worms, nematodes. They don't really have much of a brain also. A lot of their processing is in different parts of their neural network.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even with us, some of our processing isn't only
doesn't
in our brain.
Central, yeah.
You know, when you talk about motor memory, mm-hmm. pianists or, mm-hmm. you know, if you how do you know where your legs are when you're walking or if mm-hmm. you could scratch your arm? These are some of this information is in the nerves in our peripheral nerval system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you can process information without a brain. Again, you can't do linear algebra without a brain. You can't be considering economics without a brain. But who says that that's the most important thing in life?
It's really tricky to figure out exactly how to see in a way that's not species-centric, be generous with what we see in these other species, plants in this case, and yet not project all of our stuff on them either. Ed is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Ed, you're on the air with Daniel Shamovitz. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I love your show as always, Tom.
Thank you.
I've got something I want to talk to you about, the orange tree. But first, I'm in North Carolina where Venus flytraps grow. And by the way, after one of those traps closes three times, that part of the plant dies. So that's another reason it's got to be very efficient.
Yeah, no kidding. It doesn't want to come down on nothing here.
That's right. After three times, it dies and it puts out new ones. And this is where they grow indigenously uh-huh. in the world. But in orange groves in Florida, there's because of the pesticides that killed all the insects, there were no birds. And so there's a symbiotic relationship. And one farmer put loudspeakers in his orange grove with birds chirping, and young tree death disappeared. It's kind of like a teenager dying, which is a big problem in Florida. Plus, his orange trees produce like 20 or 30% more oranges and 30 or 40% more juice. So there's a... And the birds in the trees is I figure the plants can understand the bird sound.
Well, Ed, you may be stumping my pro here because he's got a whole chapter on what a plant hears, and his answer in that chapter is nothing. The plants are deaf. So, what do you make, Daniel Shamovitz, of loudspeakers with bird song? Maybe.
We got to differentiate between mm-hmm. two things. I mean, there are examples in agriculture where certain sounds have led to higher yields. But as the caller said,
I thought the experiment you cited was just the opposite.
No, but the question
just
is,
this sort of the secret life of plants that Mozart made them grow taller?
I'm talking here about yields and not a certain thing. But the question in this one, and again, I'm not an agronomist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are these bird songs then calling to other insects, which are then going to be calling to other types of birds to come in,
which intervene.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's the sound waves itself that are having any effect.
But and maybe I have complex to temper this. Web of
exactly.
responses.
Mm-hmm. You know, because unfortunately, the only thing we can go on is what we have in our scientific body of knowledge, which is published research.
Mm-hmm.
And over the past 100 years, there are literally hundreds, even thousands of articles dealing with plant vision, hundreds of articles just in the past decade of plants responses to smell. There is nothing, maybe one or two articles, dealing with plant responses to sound. Now, not all scientists are the most original people in the world.
Yeah.
You know, if there was something to go there, people would be doing these experiments.
But you make some pretty tough positive claims that plants just don't hear, that they're deaf.
Well, the positive
claim is related to human deafness.
Oh, no. Okay.
Did I misread that?
Oh, I did a lot of hand-waving in that chapter.
All right.
I want to take it
help
two steps
then.
At a time.
Okay.
So first of all, there's no evidence, solid, genetic, biological evidence with the proper controls that show that plants respond to sound waves. Mm-hmm. Definitely none that plants respond to music.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's talk about music for 1 second, just because, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, these are experiments that a lot of kids do in school.
Mm-hmm.
This was a lot of the experiments that were in The Secret Life of Plants.
Mm-hmm.
What relevance is music to a plant ecologically? You know, when we're talking about plant vision, I don't go and show them a chart with a big E on the top and ask it to read the bottom
side. Show them light that they need.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so a plant doesn't really care if it's Pink Floyd or Mozart. And actually, most of the experiments that have been done that mm-hmm. people tried to publish mm-hmm. or put in the popular press
mm-hmm.
for some reason, the plants grew in the music that the person who was doing the experiment preferred. So now, I'm not saying they were out to cheat us, but, you know, we're also affected. And so maybe, you know, if it was music we liked, we gave it a little bit more water. We gave it a little bit more fertilizer.
But hang on, once you tell us, and we'll look at more of these, but the plants see and smell and feel, and then we start to put that together and maybe project a sense that the plant has emotions. And once the plant has emotions, then we project that music would matter.
Yeah. So, yeah, plants don't have emotions. They're not subjective. I think, all right, some people, one of my friends says, oh, you're not going far enough. Maybe we just don't know that they don't. There's no evidence. You know, I think you need a frontal cortex. You don't only need a brain. You need a frontal cortex to have subjective emotions. You know, even in neurobiology, human biology, we know there's a difference between suffering and pain. There are different parts of our brain. So, yeah, plants don't really care.
Maybe this is where The Secret Life of Plants went a little too far for you. This book, published in 1973, explored plant sentience, created quite a media stir back then, now regarded very skeptically by scientists. There was a documentary made in 79. Here's a little snippet from the documentary, scene in which plants are allegedly responding in a symphony of emotions to people around them.
As the people move among the plants, the sounds they hear are the plants reacting to their presence. An ephemeral exchange of energy linking two diverse life forms becomes a symphony of emotions.
All right, there from The Secret Life of Plants, the 1979 documentary. And Daniel Shemovitz, I see your face registering skepticism, but then maybe a note of, I don't know, sympathy. What about it? A symphony of emotions, an ephemeral exchange of energy. It is. We like the idea.
Well, an ephemeral exchange of energy. I don't even know what that means. But the first part, she said, you know, the plants respond to us around them. You know, that's what I was saying in the beginning. Mm-hmm. Yeah, plants are responding to us around them. They just don't care about us. You know, we care about them.
Move your shadow, mister.
Exactly.
But that's it.
Mm-hmm. You know. So, you know, if we want to go back to this idea, you mentioned the idea that plants had deaf genes.
Mm-hmm.
I did a little hand waving about saying, but that's not why plants are deaf. You know, we don't have genes for us to be deaf.
Mm-hmm.
We have genes that when they're mutated cause deafness. Just like, you know, the gene for breast cancer isn't there, so there'll be breast cancer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And when one of the really exciting things that happened in plant biology in 2000, when they sequenced the first plant genome, they found that plants had the gene for breast cancer. Plants had the gene for deafness. Now, again, you look at a plant, there are no breasts there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, why is there the gene for breast cancer? Because the breast cancer gene is there to help cells divide properly. When it goes wrong,
mm-hmm.
then you haywire, then you mm-hmm. get breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Deafness gene is not there so that we are deaf. It's there to help, for example, one of the genes to grow the hairs in our ear.
The filaments
that help us
sound.
That help
mm-hmm.
us hear.
Mm-hmm.
Plants have the same genes because plants also have filaments.
Mm-hmm.
But these filaments happen to be in their roots. But what's interesting, when you make a mutation in this, and this is what we could do in plant biology, we mm-hmm. can make mutants no problem.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They lose their filaments on their roots.
Wow. And so that's the plant equivalent of deafness.
Well, it's the equivalent of what that protein does, mm-hmm. making filaments.
Mm-hmm.
But it has absolutely nothing to do with the fact that plants can't hear.
Mm. Let's turn to smell, because on this front, plants do a lot. And it's really interesting to hear all of it, to take us into the plant's sense of smell.
All right. So let me just first define what I mean by smells. When we smell something, like, you know, 4th of July, your neighbor has a barbecue going on. The smell of that barbecue wafts across his lawn into your lawn.
Yo,
you smell it.
I know all about it.
And you start salivating whether you want to or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you did not make a decision to salivate. It just mm-hmm. affected you and you
Boom.
Had to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's smelling. Same thing with a plant. If you take a very ripe fruit and an unripe fruit and put them together in the same bag,
mm-hmm.
we all know this from, you know, from just experience, that that's how you could get like an avocado to soften up faster or a apple to soften up. And the reason it's doing it is because the unripe fruit mm-hmm. is smelling the ripe one. It's called ethylene.
Ethylene.
Yeah, ethylene mm-hmm. is a gas that's
ethylene.
Given off by ripe fruit.
Mm-hmm.
This gas goes in the air to the unripe fruit. It has a receptor, just like we have receptors in our nose for smelling.
Mm-hmm.
This fruit has a receptor for the ethylene. It senses the ethylene and then immediately starts ripening.
So put a ripe banana in a paper bag with an unripe avocado.
and it'll soften up
that avocado will soften up faster.
You know, there's what's the expression? You know, one bad apple spoils the bunch.
Yeah.
It's because if you have something that's really so ripe it's rotten, it'll cause all the other ones to ripen much too fast.
So in a way,
they're smelling each other.
They are smelling right there. And you go on. You say plants know when their fruit is ripe, when their neighbor has been cut by a gardener's shears, or when their neighbor's being eaten by a ravenous bug. Is all that by a kind of smelling?
All that's by a kind of smell. Their main communication seems to be among plants is through smelling each other. Research that was started in the early 80s in Cornell University, they found that when a tree is attacked by bugs, by beetles, the leaves are ripped. And that gives off some type of signal that the trees next to it smell it. And what happens, and they start making their own chemicals in the leaves that are poisonous to the bugs. Now, when this first research came out, people, a lot of biologists didn't believe it, but the popular press loved it. The New York Times even had an article
They're
said
screaming
that,
to each other.
That said, you know, a plant's bark is better than its bite.
And if it's gardener's shears, same thing or something else?
Well, a plant doesn't know why its leaf has been ripped.
Mm-hmm.
It just knows that its leaf has been ripped.
And it's telling the other plants around it, leaf ripping going on.
Exactly. Here. So the scientist who actually discovered this as a graduate student now then is now the director of the Max Planck Institute in Germany. You know, he's a very famous scientist.
Yeah, yeah.
It was not accepted. Science is self-correcting.
Mm-hmm.
It's sometimes new ideas are difficult to accept, but if they are supported, other people are going to follow up it. And this has become a new paradigm in plant biology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it took it a while. There was a lot of, you know, it's overinterpretation of the work.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been shown to be a real paradigm that plants communicate this way. Now, the question, though, is, I mean, is it that the plants are communicating?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it that they're just listening to each other? So, you know, why would a tree want to warn
its
neighbor?
What's the difference?
Well, one we can anthropomorphize. It's saying, oh, watch out. You're going to be, you know, attacked. Help yourself.
Yeah.
The other one is that one branch on the same tree is communicating to each other. It wants to save itself.
Mm-hmm.
And its neighbor is just eavesdropping.
But eavesdropping is a kind of communication.
Yeah, but we're not intending it. The question is intent.
Well, whose intent here?
Yeah.
I mean, if I'm listening to you, there's something going on.
That's
it's not
true.
Two stones
yeah, exactly.
sitting next to
okay,
one
I'll accept that. And we also have to remember that a lot of plants are what we call clonal, like aspen trees, mm-hmm. what we see as individual trunks. They all have the same root system. It's actually one big organism.
Not to mention all those beautiful leaves fluttering in the Rocky
exactly.
Mountains.
Exactly. I'm just picturing
gosh,
it right now.
It's so gorgeous.
Yeah.
So I don't know if the leaves fluttering means anything to them, but underground, they're all they're communally tapped up there together.
Exactly.
So smelling, and they're smelling ripeness, and they're not just perceiving it, then they're
responding.
Responding. Their action is being triggered by that. They're saying, yeah, I'll
you know,
have some of that ripeness too.
They're salivating,
let's go.
You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're equivalent thereof.
You know, so again, we always think, oh, because smell for us has emotion, it has pictures. You know, mm-hmm. we think we're deciding what we're going to think.
Mm-hmm.
That's another question, you know, for philosophers.
Yeah, right. How high concept are we really?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm salivating at your barbecue. Yeah. That doesn't.
I didn't want to, you know.
Right.
Weight Watchers told me to move away, but I just couldn't.
Here's a tomato, slush box. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour looking at the cool science of what plants feel, smell, see, and remember with Daniel Shamovitz. He's a biologist from Tel Aviv University with me in the studio today at the Manna Center, as in manna from heaven,
manna
that kind of
heaven.
Manna? Wow, okay, just like Moses' time.
Well, we're lucky that we have a donor who's very very modest and was actually one of these people who didn't want her name.
Wasn't her name, but manna.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, we'll take manna. Manna works.
Exactly. We've got to feed the world.
Feed the world. Get an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Here's a listener says, for years as a teacher in Jamaica, she writes, I grew to love the shame old lady plant, they call it in Jamaica, which grew everywhere in the country. It was touch sensitive and would fold up its leaves and branches when touched by a passersby. You know this one. You write about this by another name, I think, in your book, Dan.
Oh, yeah, the mimosa plant. But it's called in every part of the world. It has its own, what did she call it? The shame
old lady.
Yeah,
it kind of makes sense, like touch it and it's just,
and actually in India, it's called the shy virgin.
Okay.
And in Israel, it's called the don't touch me.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's it do? She's got it just about right.
You got it just about right. You know, touch it and its leaves fold on up. It's really, again, we can identify with it because we see it, you know, moving. We see the movement.
And there's that sense of touch. How else does that show up in the plant world? That sense of a plant knowing it's being touched.
Well, when is a plant touched usually? It's touched by the wind. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're a hiker, you mm-hmm. know, and you've been up on top of a mountain and you see a short, squat tree, and down in the valley, the same tree is tall and majestic.
Same species.
The same species, yeah, mm-hmm. not the exact same tree.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The reason it's short and squat on top is because it's being shook by the wind all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it knows that it's being shaken. And that causes it to change its development and put all its resources into making a strong trunk so it doesn't get blown over. But down in the valley where it's not experiencing this trauma, mm-hmm. it can put all of its energy into making a beautiful, majestic leaf.
Now, but people could look canopy. At it and say, well, you know, that's not like us. We think about things and we produce cathedrals. A tree on a mountaintop is just doing that because it has no choice. It's just that's all the resources it gets up there. The wind won't let it do something else. Yeah. But you're
well,
saying
I'm going to give a really awful example.
And, okay.
You know, we also told you that you can't shake animals or shake our children. You know, it also mm-hmm. affects our development.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of course it's not okay. the same thing. But even in yeah. even in California,
uh-huh.
you know, you put your resources into the foundation of your building,
mm-hmm.
or do you put it into making it, you know, beautiful? So when we're doing architecture,
right.
we're taking into account the same principles.
Quite true. Let's go to Aiken, South Carolina, and Brenda. Brenda, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Daniel Shemovitz.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am so excited. You've had many great programs, but this one is it. I have known my whole life, even as a little kid, I have known that plants know. Now, I believe almost everything Daniel says, but he's wrong that they don't hear. I think he's well into wisdom here, but he has to open up his belief. But I love that science is now documenting some of these things. And I wonder if he knows, if he's aware of the article in Discover magazine. That's a little magazine that tracks cutting-edge science across all fields of science. And a few years ago, they had an article about audio communication between trees, where they send out alarm when a pest invades, when a pest gets to one tree. Now, they had tracked chemical alarms, chemical mm-hmm. communication mm-hmm. among trees.
Well, part of this comes down to how we define what these different instances are. I'll put it, Brenda, I'm so grateful for, happy for your call, but let me put this particular thing to you, Daniel. I mean, how are you going to characterize that? Is that hearing or is that something else?
Well, I want to differentiate between two things, which is belief and data. And as a scientist, we have to look for the data. So until there is data with real controls showing that plants respond to sounds, we have to accept that for now, the data shows that they don't respond.
But part of it is categorization. Brenda
but there was
calls
actually
this hearing. Maybe you call it smelling.
But there's actually
alarm.
An article that was published just 2 weeks ago, which sort mm-hmm. of, I might have to rewrite this chapter. There's a group of scientists in Italy at the International Laboratory for Plant Neurobiology, which mm-hmm. is a problematic term maybe.
That's all right.
But they're not playing music to plants.
Uh-huh.
They're saying, well, what would be normal for a plant? If a plant hears, what would it respond to?
Mm-hmm.
And they've been looking at subsonic waves, which is also auditory, that are going through the ground and how it's affecting root development.
Okay.
And they're preliminary, and I have to, you know, say that it is very preliminary results, showed that roots seem to change their growth according to subsonic waves.
It's kind of a whale song equivalent.
Exactly. So plants may be listening.
Mm-hmm.
But not the things that we're looking for. Mm-hmm. You know,
maybe
so we
way
have
way down at that level.
So we have, or maybe the really high pitch of a bug's wings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm hopeful that in the next few years, this type of research will be looked at more. But again, I only can look at what's been published by accepted scientists in good laboratories doing proper controls, and it's just not there.
And the
yet.
The alarm tree to tree, it sounds like you're ready to call that smell.
Yeah, I think that was smell. I know that article, and I think mm-hmm. if you go back, you'll look, that was about the olfactory, the mm-hmm. chemical signaling, mm-hmm. and not the hearing. They might have been using some wrong terminology to make it understandable, saying it's calling out, but it's calling out through chemicals, not through sound.
Brenda, I'm glad for your call. Watch out for the whale song version of plant hearing. I don't know. Heather in Lawrence, Massachusetts. Heather, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Very well. What do you know?
Well, this is a really interesting thing that happened as I was listening to you. I started to think, what is it that we can learn about our own senses from plants? Because my husband spent the last 10 years sort of headed into the end stages of Alzheimer's, okay. and he became more and more plant-like. It was very odd. And he mm-hmm. first he lost the word for plants, so he called them green friends. But the more he deteriorated, the more he wanted to be in rooms with plants. And he got down to where his brain was a third of its normal size. He couldn't see except to distinguish whether something was light or dark. He couldn't speak. He couldn't move. He kind of had to be turned and watered and everything else.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting to watch his reaction and to watch him actually calm down when he was in places where there were more plants. And I think what happened to me is by watching him and trying to hear what he was saying, you know, when he got down to the only thing he could move was the toes on his left foot,
yeah.
and he couldn't vocalize, I got actually better at taking care of my plants. And I was wondering, you know, if we're just trapped in situations where we can't move, do we use our senses more in the way that they do?
Wow. Wow. Let us look at it, Heather. That's quite the story of moving toward a plant-like state. We have disparagingly called that, you know, vegetating, but maybe there's some communion. I don't know. What do you say,
that's
Daniel?
A very moving story. And I think, you know, these life experiences make us question, you know, what makes us human mm-hmm. and what really is experience. Now, if we look at a plant, you know, we call people a vegetable and a plant-like thing. Mm-hmm. You know, what is the main evolutionary constraint in my mind that sort of ties in with what you're saying that defines a plant and makes it this sensual organism
mm-hmm.
is that it's rooted. It's sessile. They can't
mm-hmm.
move.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like
off
what happened to her.
Anyway.
Yeah, because of your husband, mm-hmm. her husband.
Mm-hmm.
So a plant, you know, if you're thirsty, you know, you could go to the Starbucks yeah. down the street. You know, if you're cold, you could put on a sweater or go to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're looking for a mate, I don't know where you'll go, but you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
Plants are stuck where they are. Mm-hmm. They can move, you know, like a foot, you know, grow left, right, but they can't migrate. They can't escape. They can't go on vacation. And because of this, they really have evolved these highly complex sensory mechanisms to enable them to survive without moving.
About survival in a fixed location.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I would pour concrete in here and leave you mm-hmm. in this room, you mm-hmm. wouldn't last too long.
Mm-hmm.
But a plant would
mm-hmm.
because it can.
To maximize
exactly.
this spot.
And that's why genetically, most plants have more genes than humans.
We just had the tomato genome sequence.
Exactly. That was great. Well, first of all, I like the tomato song. So that, mm. you know, last week, the tomato genome was sequenced. And like other plant genomes, that shows that, for example, the tomato genome has 7,000 more genes than humans have.
What does that mean? When we hear those kind of, does it mean plants are more sophisticated than we are, or we just have learned how to run more efficiently?
Define sophisticated.
Top hat and tail.
Yeah, well, definitely. Well, then I know some people who are more and less sophisticated.
No, but you know what
genetically,
I mean.
Plants in certain ways are more sophisticated because they have to be. Sometimes they have two copies of a gene, one for good days and one for a bad day. You know, when
the
we look at these,
gene.
You know, we have four different light receptors. Plants have 13, one for high light days, one for low light days, mm-hmm. one for a good hair day, one for a bad hair day.
They can't yeah. move, so they've got to deal with it as it is. Maybe that
exactly.
needs a few more genes right there.
Exactly.
Gosh, Heather, thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate it. Let's go to Marie in Newton, Massachusetts. Marie, you're on.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Tom, yeah. Daniel. What a marvelous, marvelous program. And I've been thinking about my plants for a long, long time. What I do early in the morning when I get up is put on WBUR.
My station right here in Boston. Oh, come on.
Oh, yes. My plants are thriving. It's in a sunroom, right, the radio is. But the other piece of it that's, I think, the most important piece is that I had a dog, Christmas Rose. People in the neighborhood will recognize that.
Yeah.
And she was killed a month ago.
Oh, sorry.
In an accident on the street.
Yeah.
But... Oh. So I didn't have the radio on. I was in mourning, didn't have the radio on, and my plants started to diminish. And then I know that there's a correlation between how plants vibrate and our own energy. I know that correlation. So I said, well, I've got to cease this mourning, or not cease it, but at least put on back on the radio.
Show mercy, right.
Yes. And they're thriving now. I have a little memorial to her outside. Inside, the plants are thriving. I decided to, they asked me to be repotted. A couple that I had neglected, so I repotted them. They're blooming again.
Oh, Marie, so, you're hitting our buttons at so many levels here. We're sorry about Christmas Rose, and to lose a dog is terrible. But your plants at least have the have our station back on. Well, I don't know how much we can claim here.
Well, no, it's perfect because Marie, I think you really hit it on the nail. You said you had been neglecting your plants when you were in mourning. Your plants withered because you had been neglecting them, and now they're coming back to life when you're giving them the attention they need.
Memory, Marie will have it of Christmas Rose. You say plants have it. Plants remember anyway. Meaning?
Yeah. Well, what's memory? Memory is you have to gather information, store it, and recall it.
Give us some examples then.
So again, we talked about the Venus flytrap. It remembers that the first
hair
was touched, and it recalls that information when the second one is. Mm-hmm. But if it goes too long, it's lost the memory. It's sort of like our short-term memory. Mm-hmm. Ask me what room I'm in my hotel, I don't remember anymore because, it was too long ago.
Right.
So that's like an example of short-term memory. But plants also have longer-term memories. For example, wheat. Wheat will only flower if it's gone through a winter. That's going so it has to go through. It has to gone through a cold spell, and then it waits till the daylights have gotten the right time, and then it'll flower. But if it hasn't gone through that long cold winter, it won't flower. So it remembers its past weather.
But we don't generally give it credit for that. We say, "Oh, that's just what wheat does. It comes after the winter. Doesn't have a brain full of memories."
Yeah, but we have a lot of memories that we don't remember in our brain also, and the easiest example is immune memory. When I had chicken pox before, there were, my body now remembers that I had that virus. It doesn't do it with the brain. But what's actually cool about it is a lot of the mechanisms behind vegetal memory, electricity, and what's called epigenetics are the same mechanisms that work in our own brains. So the mechanisms are the same, the cells are different.
Epigenetics meaning?
Epigenetics is different structure of the DNA. The DNA changes its structure, but not its sequence, not the nucleic acids in a row.
As people listen to all these senses active in plants as you describe them, I'm sure here's a listener in Vermont who writes, "Geez, don't tell my daughter about this. She already doesn't eat animals. Emotional reasons, not potential health reasons. Not much left if you don't eat plants either." You're going to have people saying, "What? You're kidding me. Plants know when I'm chewing on them. I'm not going to chew on them anymore. Nothing left to eat."
Yeah, but don't forget that plants don't care. There's no brain. You need a brain to care. That's number one. Number two, plants want to be eaten. They're not saying, "Please eat." Well, actually, they are. When a fruit ripens, it's like a display saying, "Come eat me."
Smells good.
Why does a plant want to be eaten? Because that's how its seeds are spread around.
True. The birds and everything else.
Why are fruits and vegetables colored? To call herbivores. Not to call me at the supermarket, but to call herbivores to come and eat it. So they really do want to be eaten. So
I'm luscious.
Exactly. Tell your daughter she's fine. The plants are going to survive fine, and there's no pain involved.
It's part of the plan.
Actually, on April Fool's Day, I wrote a blog about how grass screams with a lawnmower, and it meant to be a joke. And this was picked up, and people freaked out. I knew it. Like I said, "No, it's April Fool's. It's April Fool's."
Okay.
Golfers are really upset.
Gimli writes to us, "We're constantly surprised to find that living things aren't stupid." I think that there's a great readiness right now to look out on the ball of life that is the earth and say, no, it's not stupid. There's a connectedness here that really you take us to with these observations.
Yeah, the idea of stupid and intelligence, I don't even want to touch that because, you know, we don't even know what intelligence is for us. You know, the definition of intelligence, that's, you know, my wife did her PhD on that to a certain extent, and mm-hmm. psychologists could go on for hours. Mm-hmm. But if we're going to talk about, let's talk about it anyway, intelligence. You know, I don't think intelligence evolved just in humans. And Anthony Trevallos, who's an esteemed plant biologist who really was the first people to talk about plant intelligence, said intelligence must have evolved also in earlier organisms. It just didn't appear in humans. We're the only ones who think about it, though.
Wow. It's a terrific book, and we're so grateful for all your insights on it. Daniel Shemovitz, thanks for the insights.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
What a plant knows. Just terrific. Thanks for joining us. And the program note today, listeners, June 14th, On Point Live will be in Boston. Come out and join us. Bill McKibben will be there, battle captain in the environmental movement. Martin Sexton there, Jack Beatty. It'll be a great time. All the details at onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.